Diana and I have recently viewed some true astronaut stories about the Challenger, Discovery, and other NASA LAT launches. Quite incredible. John Glenn knew how to fly a fighter jet. He completed 59 missions in World War II and 90 in the Korean War, and he knew how to fly fast. He was the first pilot to average supersonic speed on a transcontinental flight, and he knew how to fly into outer space. In 1962, he became the first American to orbit the Earth. John Glenn also knew how to win elections. He was a United States Senator from 1974 to 1999, and John Glenn could do much, give speeches, lead committees, inspire audiences, write books. Yet for all his accomplishments, there is still one skill he never mastered. He never learned to tell his wife goodbye. The two met when they were toddlers and grew up together in New Concord, Ohio. Though John went on to achieve national fame, he would tell you that the true hero of the family is the girl he married in 1943. Annie suffered from such severe stuttering that 85% of her efforts to speak fell short. She couldn't talk on the phone, order food in a restaurant, or give verbal instructions to a taxi driver. The idea of requesting help in a department store intimidated her, and she would wander the aisles, reluctant to speak. She feared the possibility of a family crisis because she didn't know if she could make the 911 call. Hence, the difficulty with goodbye. John bore the thought of separation, and so the two developed a code. And each time he was deployed on a mission or call to travel, the couple bid each other farewell the same way. "I'm just going down to the corner store to get a pack of gum," he'd say.
"Don't be long," she'd reply, and off he'd go to Japan, Korea, or even outer space. Over the years, Annie's speech improved. Intense therapy clarified her enunciation skills and improved her confidence. Even so, goodbye was the one word the couple could not say to each other. In 1998, Senator Glenn became the oldest astronaut in history, and he re-entered space aboard the shuttle Discovery. Upon departure, he told his wife, "I'm just going down to the corner store and get a pack of gum," but this time he gave her a present, a pack of gum, and she kept it in a pocket near her heart until he was safely home. Goodbye. Nobody wants to say it. Not the spouse of an astronaut. Not the mom of a soon-to-be preschooler. Not the father of the bride. Nor the husband in the convalescent home. Not the wife in the funeral home. Death is the interloper, the intruder, the stick figure sketch in the Louvre. It doesn't fit. Why would God give a fishing buddy and then take him? Fill a crib and then empty it? No matter how you frame it, goodbye doesn't feel right. Max Lucado points out that Jacob and Joseph lived beneath the shadow of goodbye. When the brothers lied about Joseph's death, they gave Jacob a blood-soaked tunic. "A wild beast dragged the body away," they implied. Jacob collapsed in sorrow. And then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, mourned for his son many days. Jacob wept until the tears turned to brine, until his soul shriveled. The two people he loved the most were gone. Rachel dead, Joseph dead. Jacob, it seems, died. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. No, he said, I will continue to mourn until my son is in the grave. And so his father wept for him. It was in just about all the ways that counted, Jacob had given up. Joseph lived with the same sorrow as 2 decades passed. No word from home, birthdays, holidays, harvest days. Jacob was never far from his thoughts. And the moment Joseph revealed his identity to his brothers, he asked, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? Question number one, how's Dad? Priority number one, a family reunion. Joseph told his brothers to saddle up, ship out, come back with the entire family. Genesis chapter 45, beginning at verse 21. He gave them supplies for the journey, and Joseph gave each of them new clothes. But to Benjamin he gave 5 changes of clothes, 300 pieces of silver. He also sent his father 10 male donkeys, loaded with the finest products of Egypt, and 10 female donkeys, loaded with grain and bread and other supplies he would need on his journey. So Joseph sent his brothers off, and as they left, he called after them, don't quarrel about these things along the way. And they left Egypt, returned to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan. Jacob's boys returned to Canaan in style. Gone were the shabby robes and emancipated donkeys. They drove brand new pickup trucks packed with gifts. They wore leather jackets and alligator skin boots. Their wives and kids spotted them on the horizon. You're back! You're back! Hugs and back slaps all around. Jacob emerged from a tent. A rush of hair, long and silver, reached his shoulders. Stooped back, face leathery like raw hide. He squinted at the sun-kissed sight of his sons and all of the plunder. He was just about to ask them where they stole all the stuff, when one of them blurted out, Joseph is still alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart stood still, because he did not believe them. The old man grabbed his chest. He had to sit down. Leah brought him some water and glared at the sons as if to say they better not be playing a joke on their father. But this was no trick. When they told him all the words which Joseph had said to them, and when he saw the carts which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. Sadness had sapped the last drop of joy out of Jacob. Yet when the sons told him what Joseph had said, how he had asked about Jacob, how he had called them to Egypt, Jacob's spirit revived. He looked at the prima facie evidence of carts and clothes. He looked at the confirming smiles and nods of his sons, and for the first time in more than 20 years, the old patriarch began to believe he would see his son again. His eyes began to sparkle, his shoulders straightened, and then Israel said, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. Yes, the narrator calls Jacob by his other name, given by God in Genesis 37:28, Israel. The promise of a family reunion can do this. It changes us from sad to seeking, from lonely to longing, from hermit to pilgrim, from Jacob the heel grabber to Israel, Prince of God. So Israel took his journey with all that he had, and he came to Beersheba. and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Jacob was 130 years old by this point, hardly a spring chicken. He had a hitch in his get-along, an ache in his joints, but nothing was going to keep him from his son, so he took his staff in hand and issued the command, "Load him up! We are heading to Egypt." And as the entourage drew near, Jacob leaned forward to get a better glimpse of the man in the center chariot. And when he saw his face, Jacob whispered, "Joseph, my son." Across the distance, Joseph leaned forward in his chariot, and he told his driver to slap the horse. When the two groups met on the flat of the plain, the prince didn't hesitate. He bounded out of his chariot and ran in the direction of his father. The moment Joseph saw him, he threw himself on his neck and wept. Gone were the formalities. Forgotten were the priorities. Joseph buried his face in the crook of his father's shoulder, and, quote, "he wept a long time." As tears moistened the robe of his father, both men resolved that they would never say goodbye to each other again. Max counsels goodbye. For some of you, this word is the challenge of your life. To get through this is to get through raging loneliness, strength-draining grief. You sleep alone in a double bed. You walk the hallways of a silent house. You catch yourself calling out his name or reaching for her hand. And as with Jacob, the separation has exhausted your spirit. You feel quarantined, isolated. The rest of the world has moved on. You ache to do the same, but you can't. You simply can't say goodbye. But if you can't, take heart. God has served notice. All farewells are on the clock, and they are filtering like grains of sand through an hourglass. If heaven's throne room has a calendar, one day is circled in red and highlighted in yellow. God has decreed a family reunion. 1 Thessalonians 4:16 through 18, one of my favorite passages. I'm reading it out of the Message. The Master himself will give the command, archangel thunder, God's trumpet blast. He'll come down from heaven, and the dead in Christ will rise. They'll go first. Then the rest of us who are still alive at the time will be caught up with them into the clouds to meet the Master. Oh, we'll be walking on air. And then there will be one huge family reunion with the Master. So reassure one another with these words. The Encouraging Word Bible comments on this passage. An intriguing verse is found in 1 Thessalonians 4:16. For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel and with the trumpet call of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Have you ever wondered what that loud command will be? It'll be the inaugural word of heaven. It'll be the first audible message most have ever heard from God. It'll be the word that closes one age, opens a new one. I think I know what the command will be. I could very well be wrong, but I think the command which will put an end to the last pains of the earth and initiate the joys of heaven will actually be two words, no more. The King of Kings will raise his pierced hand and proclaim, "No more." The angels will stand and the Father will speak, "No more." Every person who lives and whoever lived will turn toward the sky and hear God announce, no more. No more loneliness. No more tears. No more death. No more sadness. No more crying. No more pain. As John sat on the island of Patmos, surrounded by sea and separated from friends, he dreamt of the day when God would say, no more. This same disciple who has heard Jesus speak these words of assurance over half a century before now knew what they meant. I wonder if he could hear the voice of Jesus in his memory saying, the end will come. For those who live for this world, that's bad news. But for those who live for the world to come, it's an encouraging promise. This day will be no small day. It will be the great day. The archangel will inaugurate it with a trumpet blast, and thousands of angels will appear in the sky. Cemeteries, seas will give up their dead. Christ will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. His coming will be the only event witnessed by all humanity. Every eye will see him, we read in Revelation 1:7. Moses will be watching. Napoleon's head will turn. The eyes of Martin Luther and Christopher Columbus will widen. The wicked despot of Hades and the white-robed martyr of paradise. From Adam to the baby born at the very as the trumpet blares, everyone will witness this moment. Just as the book of Genesis lists the family of Jacob, the book of life lists the family of God. He'll call the name of each person who has accepted his invitation. He will hear the honor the request of those who refused him and dismiss them for eternity. And then he'll bless the desire of those who accepted him and gather them for a family reunion. And what a reunion it'll be! He'll wipe away every tear from their eyes. His first action will be to rub a thumb across the cheek of every child, as if to say, there, there, no more tears. This long journey will come to an end, and you will see him, and you will see them. And isn't this our hope? There will be one huge family reunion with the Master. So comfort one another with these words. Stephen Curtis Chapman and his wife, Mary Beth, are banking on this promise. In May 2008, their beautiful 5-year-old daughter was killed in an automobile accident. And since Stephen is an internationally known and beloved Christian singer, words of support and concern poured in from all over the globe. Letters, emails, phone calls. The Chapmans were deluged by messages of kindness. One conversation in particular gave Stephen strength. Pastor Greg Laurie, who had lost a son in an auto accident, told Stephen, remember, your future with Maria is infinitely greater than your past with her. Death seems to take so much. We bury not just a body, but the wedding that never happened, the golden years we never knew. We bury dreams. But in heaven those dreams will come true, for God has promised a restoration of all things. All things. And this includes all relationships. Your grandpa, aunt, your child. They are looking forward to the day when God's family is back together. And shouldn't we do the same? Since we are surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses,
Let us run with endurance the race that God has set before us. High above us, there is a crowd of witnesses. They are the Abrahams and Jacobs and Josephs from all generations and nations, and they have completed their own events and now witness the races of their spiritual, if not physical, descendants. Listen carefully, the passage compels, and you will hear a multitude of God's children urging you on. Run, they shout. Run. You'll get through this. Our final home will hear no goodbyes. We'll speak of the good book and remember good faith, but goodbyes? Gone forever. So let the promise change you from sagging to seeking, from mournful to hopeful, from dwellers in the land of goodbye to a heaven of hellos. The prince has decreed a homecoming. Let's take our staffs and travel in his direction. Selah.